Hello, everyone, and welcome to Historia Canadiana. My name is Patrick, and with me is our official Irishman, or at least 1/16th Irishman of the show, Mackenzie.
Hey, howdy, what's going on?
I'm doing just fine, and you?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
Doing good.
Yeah, all right.
Just living my best life.
I was half expecting you to just go and lean in on an Irish accent for the intro.
I considered it for half a second, but then I remembered that the Irish kind of went through hell while they were here, so I'm going to... Let's do it with respect, Patrick. Gosh.
Okay, I'm sorry. So yeah, today we're going to be talking about, broadly speaking, the cultural impact of the Irish. And by that I mean, we're not going to be focusing on a single cultural item, like we're not talking about a book or a politician. We're not even really going to touch much on Grosse Ile, like the famine that's very well known for the Irish. We did a whole episode on that island if you want to check it out. What we're going to be talking about is basically the pre-Confederation impact in terms of music, in terms of religion, in terms of general overall population that the Irish had in coming to Canada. Kind of like what I did with the Scottish just before Matt came on the show. This was around episode 13 or so. So if you want to have an idea of that, we're just basically setting the groundwork for the impact of this population. And it'll be a bit more of a free-flowing show. Before we get started into that, however, I want to remind everyone that you can support the show through the likes of Patreon if you want extra episodes or early episodes for as little as $1 a month, or you can get the $3 a month episode. You can also support the show through PayPal, the recommended reading page, all that good stuff. If you want to know more about that, listen to the end of the show. All right, so getting into it, Mac, you mentioned something very interesting before we started recording. And that you have a bit of an Irish heritage, right? So I wasn't really joking when I was introducing you. You're kind of the person among us who has a bit more of this Irish heritage.
Among the two of us. Again, I say that, but it's like 1/16th Irish blood. It's my mother's grandmother. So my great grandmother. Mm-hmm. It's never anything I've ever been in touch with, you know, because again, it is so small and it just wasn't such a factor in my life.
Okay.
But I asked my mother before the podcast if she had any stories or like things she could tell me about her, my grandmother. So she gave me a little bit. So she came over and she was, I believe it was a maid. She's one of the ones that landed here in a ship. Okay. So this would probably be like early 20th century.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. So she was indentured and she was a housemaid for the rich people of Montreal. Her name was Mary Burgess. Mm-hmm. She would iron everything and she knew how to do everything because she'd been doing so since the age of 12. She couldn't read. She couldn't write. The only thing she knew how to read, apparently, was the price.
Oh.
She would know how to read prices. So that way she could know if the butcher was fucking her over on the meat selection.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. That makes perfect sense, actually.
Honestly. Yeah. If you need to learn, like if you can only choose certain things, you're going to need to learn how to read. You're not going to pick Shakespeare.
No. If you had asked me to guess, it would have been probably either the Bible, like selections of Psalms or whatever, mm-hmm. or yeah, something really practical, like weights or prices. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a kind of an interesting way to begin, right? Because today we're going to be talking about essentially two periods of Irish migration, pre-1815 and post-1815, because that's kind of... Pre-1815 and post-1815 kind of have two distinct ways in which the Irish migrated. In no small part due to the fact that before and after that, Irish was respectively not part of the United Kingdom and then a part of the United Kingdom, right? So it kind of changes the dynamic as to how you travel to one place or another and mm-hmm. why you do so. The basic idea, however, of both migrations are essentially the same. It's mostly work-related, much like your grandmother would have mentioned, and it's mostly for reasons of living and survival and living conditions. Right? So we're going to be talking a bit today about some of the ways in which that permeates in cultural items like folktales, like music. But I want to keep something really important in mind throughout this whole discussion, which I think will be pretty easy to do. And that is this question of the Irish as simultaneously a very separated community and a perceivedly unified one. And what I mean by that is that when we talk about the Irish, both at home in Ireland and here in Canada, we have a tendency to look at it in two ways. On the one hand, we have a tendency to look at them as staunchly separated between Irish Catholics, or Green Irish, and Irish Protestants, or Orange Irish. Mm-hmm. But we also get this really interesting image of the Irish through semiotics, through the general rhetoric around them, as being this one unified people of which there are many stereotypes and of which there are many perceptions.
So many. So,
yeah. I mean, like any group that we kind of...
You could say this about any group anywhere, really. There's always going to be like this general perceived notion and then the reality or the truth. Even for, say, French Canadians, there's Quebecois, and as we covered last week, there's also Acadians, and I'm sure there's other groups of French Canadians you could search for.
Absolutely.
Even within the Quebecois, you could probably divide them based on a separation, oui ou non.
Yes, absolutely. Much more... that's not too dissimilar to the way in which you could separate the Catholics and Protestants, right? Or in terms of the Irish, because they're often separated, for example, along pro and anti-British lines, right? Loyal and disloyal to the British Empire. However, one of the things that I want to keep in mind throughout this is that these distinctions, or lack thereof, are much more fluid than we tend to give them credit for.
Right.
Or much more complex, rather, mm-hmm. I think would be a better word to describe it. Right. So just going into this, what's your perception of the general impact of the Irish in Canada? Like, what's your immediate knowledge of the Irish in Canada as a group?
Well, for imagery, the first thing that pops into mind is the flag for the city of Montreal. Mm-hmm. So for those who don't know, the flag is essentially white background, red cross on top, and then in each of the four sections is a different flower. I can't remember the other ones. It's a fleur de lis for France.
Yep.
I don't know this. I can't remember which specific one it is for English and Scottish. I think it's a rose for England.
Yes, it is.
I don't know for Scotland. It's like a thistle or something.
Yep, absolutely.
And then there's a last corner is a three-leaf clover for the Irish, mm-hmm. sort of representing like the four base cultures that made up the city at the time. Conveniently ignoring the First Nations culture that was also probably part of the whole thing, but whatever, that's another discussion.
Yep, that's like the underlying theme of all of this, by the way. We won't address it because that's just the underlying theme. It's always there.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so that's the sort of the main thing I know of the Irish, and then the other part is the Irish neighborhood that used to be really well known as the Irish neighborhood, Griffintown, mm-hmm. in Montreal, where I live very close to.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you remember as like the salient, do you know anything about Griffintown as this place, as this neighborhood, what it was, what it represented?
I feel like I do, but it's all in the back of my brain, because these are all just like small conversations I'll be having with my family as we mm-hmm. either go through walks through the city, or we're just sitting around and we're asking questions or just talking about whatever, and then my parents will bring up these little known factoids. I know it's been seen a lot less, yep. just because of the gentrification that's been going on mm-hmm. in that neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. The two examples you bring up are quite noteworthy, right? Because on the one hand, you have Griffintown, which for the longest time, even though it's outside of the purview of the time period we're talking about now, with like up until the 1850s, that is, Griffintown was this workers' part of the city, right? It was a bit more of a poor neighborhood insofar as people with lesser means could live there, right? The cost of living was less expensive. You had a large Irish population. You had a large French Canadian population. It was a very very high immigrant population in general, just because they had less resources. And so they could live there. It was a very industrial neighborhood. And the other thing you mention that's very interesting is the flag of Montreal, right? And this is indicative of the Irish impact, not only in Quebec, but on the east coast of Canada as a whole. Mm-hmm. So getting into it broadly, just a few statistics to give us an idea of what the Irish migration to Canada was like. So by the Confederation period, we estimate that the Irish formed roughly 25% of the British North American population. Right. Of the British North American, English Canadian population. You also get Gaelic, and this is where it gets a bit sketchy, because sometimes you can consider Gaelic as both Scots and Irish Gaelic. For the purposes of statistics, they kind of smash Gaelic all together. But Gaelic was actually the third most spoken language in Canada up until that time. Right? So British North America had an extremely high Irish population. Right? And they would mostly settle in the port side cities of Canada. And that's where Montreal comes in. That's where Quebec City comes in. That's where Halifax and especially Newfoundland comes in. Right? These are like the four main areas where the Irish would settle. Naturally speaking, in places like Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, you'll have much more of the English-speaking Irish or the Protestant Irish. And in Quebec, you'll have also some English-speaking ones, but you'll have the Catholics that'll be very, very present there for obvious reasons, right? The French Canadians are much more Catholic than anywhere else in Canada. So you get this really kind of separation right off the bat. Another thing that's important to note also is that in imagining these differences between the Protestant and Irish, the Protestant and Catholic Irish, you know, in keeping with this idea that we have of the Protestant being more loyal to the British and the Catholic being a bit more resistant to them, I'll give you three kind of guesses, Mac, as to guess which one was a bit more ostracized by the quote unquote mainstream Canadian British society, right?
Let me guess. It was the one that didn't agree with the British.
Yeah, kind of. Except once again, that doesn't mean that there was no place for the Irish Catholics. Mm. As I said, they went often to places like Quebec, where very quickly the Catholic Church would include them into their own hierarchy.
Right.
But again, this is all just kind of a setup to imagining the Irish coming here, right? As this kind of very diverse group, right? Even nice within one. Protestantism, you have many denominations. You have Methodism, you have Presbyterianism, right? It's not like a really unified group, even if you decide to separate it between these two major categories. Something I want to note also is that the Irish do also move west progressively with the 19th century. You'll namely see them participate mm-hmm. in the fur trade that goes all the way to BC. You'll see them as workers on the railroad that would eventually be built post-Confederation. However, a lot of that history not only is going to be outside of our purview for today, but it's rather interesting to note that a lot of it would fail to be mentioned basically by the powers that be, right? Much like the Chinese, right? For reasons that I think open us up to a wider conversation about the Irish, and that is that the Irish at this time, and even some of the Protestant Irish, were not considered to be particularly masculine or white enough. And I choose these words very selectively, right? Because within the bounds of the British Empire, you had these ideas of masculinity and Europeanness that were very, very specific. Mm-hmm. And the Irish didn't fit this. There was a lot of discrimination against them. And that's one of the reasons why they were kind of discriminated against, not only in Eastern Canada, but as they moved west. And it makes it so a lot of their history is tainted by prejudice and erasure.
Yay. Thanks, Canada.
I mean, you saw this everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
You saw this in the States a lot. You saw this in other parts of Europe as well. Because the Irish were, I mean, the Irish populations, or at least the poor Irish populations, were massive in numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Especially the Irish Catholics. You know, they were subjected to a lot of policies back home in Ireland that were imposed by the British Empire that made it so they got the short end of the stick. And so suddenly you had this influx of migrants a bit across the world that look poor, that are looking for work, that are hungry, they're dingy, and, you know, they're Catholic, which is mm-hmm. horrifying for a lot of people from Protestant countries. So you immediately get this kind of reticence to accept them within society, even though they're Christian and white, but they're not considered quite white or quite Christian. Yeah, no,
it's that damnable thing that even when people are still this all the same, people will still find a way to make themselves better above being more white.
Oh, yeah. It's like, this is getting a bit into like post-colonial theory and stuff like that, but it's what a lot of theorists from that branch of academia call basically like a double consciousness of empire and colonialism, where you're simultaneously someone who wants to move out from under this prejudice, but also actively have to be aware that in order to move out from it, you have to act exactly like the colonizer wants you to. And you can never quite achieve that.
Right.
Because by definition, you cannot, or else then there wouldn't be a distinction between the colonizer and the colonized. Now, obviously, a lot of these theorists use it not explicitly in the purposes of the Irish, but I think it works well in this case right here. I don't know. Did you have anything else to add in like this contextualizing of the Irish?
Any contextualization you give is going to sound very general in that it relates to a lot of other groups of contextualization.
Yeah.
They were persecuted. They were harmed. They were attacked while they traveled. And any history of that has since been erased.
Mm-hmm.
These are things, they're another group that you have to actively look for the history of.
Absolutely.
Especially when the consideration of the modern day Irishman or Irish person is either as the Irish gang or as some form of like, oh, happy drunk, St. Paddy's Day.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting to me, and we can get into this question after at the end of the show, but it's kind of interesting for me that the Irish, you say like erased and stuff like that. It's kind of fascinating to me that, you know, as we mentioned, they were such a large part of Canada, like just in terms of sheer numbers, right? And as we'll see, they had a huge cultural impact. And yet, until recently, there was very little conversation about them as a people outside of those very derogatory ways, mostly because of perceptions like this, right? You had these sectarian ideals, you had these prejudices against them, and also because eventually they would assimilate quite well into like mainstream Canadian society. So again, you come back to this kind of duality of them as being both outsider and profoundly inside. And so you just never hear about them for a long time. Anyway, if we look at it a bit more specifically, right, finally getting into more of the cultural elements, if we start with like a pre-1815 look, so before Ireland unites with the British state, before, you know, there's these massive famines in Ireland, you get actually still quite a bit of Irish migration. There are Irish people that are known to be here all the way as far back as New France, right? It's estimated that about 5% of the population of New France was Irish. And that's mostly probably because of the Catholic connection that was being made.
Mm-hmm.
They would also come up with many of the loyalists after the American Revolution or during the American Revolution, or as some forms of Protestants going up to Nova Scotia. And as we were mentioning, a lot of this Irish migration to Canada was often in terms of economics or working, right? And they would often end up in places like Newfoundland, right? There are fishing posts as far back as the early 18th century in Newfoundland that attracted quite a significant number of Irish migrants, right, who merged into these small communities that eventually grew into towns.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that by the late 18th century, you had pockets of Irish in Cape Breton, in New Brunswick, in Nova Scotia, that actually had their own distinct communities within British North America, or almost British North America. So I guess my first question to you, Mac, would be just imagining this right now. How do you think the fact that Ireland had not yet merged with Great Britain yet, they would only merge in 1801 with the Act of Union, how do you think that would affect their willingness to come to Canada, if at all, right? Do you think that there would be a change in relationship?
I think there's another event that would be taken in consideration. And before they merged with England, I think they would want to more when it's New France as a colony. But then after merging and then after conversion of the colony from New France into the Upper and Lower Canada, or as how it is,
yeah,
that would then it would be also be like more wanting to go over. But that sweet spot, that little period of it, they're part of England but it's still New France, I don't know if they would necessarily be able to or be welcome to go into this French colony and migrate. Yeah,
absolutely, that's definitely like something that you would see. I think also it's important to note the way I see it, I think a lot of the Irish that were come here before being a part of the British Empire, because as you say, there would be such uncertainty or less of a certainty as to how you could properly integrate. I think a lot of the Irish that would come here were in terms of either indentured servitude, as you were mentioning, where they had to come here, or in positions of power, right? And that's right. Where you get a lot more of the Irish Protestants. And you'll see, for example, you'll see examples of that. For example, Guy Carleton, one of our early governor generals for the province of Quebec, was Irish. Or mm-hmm. Robert Baldwin's father, William Warren Baldwin was his name, was also Irish. So you had these people in relative positions of power or status that were able to work within the British system. And I think that's where you'll get the distinction. You didn't yet have these massive waves of people as mm-hmm. you would after the Union, when they were looking for opportunities elsewhere outside of Ireland. And it was cheaper to come to Canada than, for example, a place like the US, because it was less expensive to come to Canada because it was inter-empire.
Canada. Woo-woo.
Yeah, like woo. One positive things.
Small victories.
Yeah, exactly. I think you bring up an interesting point, especially with the limitations that New France would have imposed. You see that, for example, with the Huguenots, which were French Protestants. They were specifically barred from entering New France, right? Just even though they were French, but because of religion, the Huguenots were Protestants. So
religion.
So exactly. So this plays a lot into the ideas that are circulating at the time. So again, you do see this indentured servitude and all that, but I think just with a major impact between pre and post 1815 is just the availabilities for the Irish here in mm-hmm. the colonies. So I think we'll just get right into the cultural items. In this period, we have two that we can look at, right? And that is the story of the Society of the Masterless Men, which is great, and I will link to in the description, like a whole story. We're going to cover basically its summary here, but the whole story will be linked in the description, and a short poem by Thomas More from 1804, which is called Canadian Boat Song. And both of them, I think, represent this different points of this early Irish migration to Canada. So Mac, I guess my first question, my question as it pertains to the Society of Masterless Men is, how would you describe this story?
Oh boy, how do I explain the Society of Masterless Men? It seems like it was a bit of it says masterless men, first of all, but it included men, women, and children. Like, it truly was a society mm-hmm. in that sort of sense. It wasn't just a gang or of outlaws, because that's what you sort of see when we first sort of open the link that we'll be linking in, is that is sort of when I begin thinking about outlaws and outlaws history, blah, blah, blah. These people were outlaws. They did break the law, but they weren't just a traveling posse or gang.
No.
They're just sort of anarchists, man. During all the colonialism, they just wanted to like chill.
Okay. Yeah. So pretty much, the Society of Masterless Men is at best, I think, a fable. For a while, it was thought that it was maybe a true, based on true events. And some of the ideas in it can definitely ring true in terms of the effects of colonialism, or like the actual society that was being set up in the colonies, right? Mm-hmm. The actual events that they're talking about, right? This settling, the society that's being set up by the British, all that is based in reality, but the masterless men themselves is a fable. Mm-hmm. And it's set roughly in the mid 18th century in Newfoundland, one of the hubs of Irish immigration. And the story often focuses on a man called Peter Caravan, I think his name was. Yeah. So Peter Caravan basically arrives in Newfoundland as someone who was indentured to the Royal Navy, and basically decides, man, this sucks. I don't want to do this. This is hard work. I'm never going to work my way out of my servitude.
Yeah.
And he takes a bunch of his cohorts. A lot of them are Irish, and they basically desert their tasks as indentured servants. And they live on the south coast of St. John's, in the woods, in caves, in forests. And
wherever they can.
Yeah, exactly. Wherever they can
be free men.
Exactly. And as Max said, this is basically an early attempt, at least according to the fable, an early attempt to establish an anarchist society in Newfoundland, right? They lived free from labor. They subsisted on food that the wilderness offered. They sometimes traded with some of the fishermen that weren't British and antagonistic towards them. And they eluded the British authorities, right? That's basically what the story says. And they lived basically happily ever after. Some of them would be caught, I think, according to some of the myths, like three or four of them would be caught and hanged, but the rest just basically lived their lives until they died out.
Yep. Again, not a hugely successful affair, but literally they weren't trying to start a movement, really. They just wanted to get away.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess one of my, a good way to start this is, why do you think that this would have been one of the earlier stories to appear in terms of the Irish in Canada? Why this type of story? Why a fable about anarchism of all things?
Because it propagates the stereotypes and myths of the Irish.
Interesting. Okay, how so?
It's just an idea, because it's going to be touching on other parts of Irish history a bit, but there's that idea of the history of the Irish as the anarchists, you know, going back to what happened in Northern Ireland and Ireland. There's a reason why there's a drink called Irish car bombs. Like, there's these ideas and stereotypes that persist. And so this story kind of feeds into that a bit, you know, the idea that there was the Irish people that didn't want to work. They just, because if you could take this story and you can frame it in a very different light of these Irishmen that came over thinking they would have an easy ride, didn't want to work, and then decided to run away and make a gang as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very interesting, because the framing, the way, or at least in the story that we took for this episode, the person who's telling it, right, is writing for an anarchist magazine, right? It's been kind of, it's a story that's been readopted by legitimate anarchist groups, right, as this kind of call to say, hey, look, this can actually work. It's literally become a founding myth, if you will, for like anarchism in Newfoundland, in which case the
very large movement, as you're all aware, anarchism.
Oh, sure. This really booming part
anarchism
of
in Newfoundland specifically.
No, but you know what I mean, right? It's been like the myth has kind of surpassed the need for reality in this case, and it represents more than we actually need it to be. And it's interesting to me that you took the kind of opposite framing of it, whereas this person who's writing under a pseudonym, so I can't really credit them beyond the name Seaweed, but they're taking this much more pro stance.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying, because this story, to survive long enough to get to the anarchist communities, this sort of myth and fable, it would have had to have been passed down a different way.
Yeah.
So if this myth / fable gets passed down, it is, of course, a call for anarchy and all that, but it's also a bit of it can be used easily propaganda either way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I have to think back in the time of pre-1815, where the more literate people who would have been telling the stories would have been the people in control, would have been like, hey, look at these shoddy anarchy guys.
Yeah, but shoddy anarchy guys, but also, why make them so successful though? Like, why make them so successful as part of the...
You can reframe them as not successful though, because they did die out. They just died out.
That's true.
Their movement amounted to nothing, even though doesn't seem like they're actually trying to start a movement. They were just trying to chill.
Yeah, they're just trying to not be part of that movement.
Yeah, or you can easily say it as, oh, they're stuck living out in the wilderness now as wanted men, criminals. I mean, as we've seen in the past couple of years, it's real easy to turn truth into lies.
Absolutely, yeah.
And lies into truth.
I also really find it interesting that in that similar way, while you can definitely frame it as like this pro-British thing of, as you're saying, it can be kind of propagandistic, it also raises another idea that you see a lot associated with the Irish, although positively, right, is it questions the legitimacy of political authority.
Right.
Especially in the context of the New World, I find the story fascinating.
Oh, for sure. This is some like very early prototypical Wild West type scenarios going on.
Yes, exactly. And you get it at a moment when Britain is really not that powerful in North America or anywhere for that matter. Their empire is really just on the edge of starting. And you're already getting these stories that just fly straight in the face of political authority. And it's so, to me, this is much more indicative of the kind of shoddy basis on which empire is formed in North America by the British and the French for that matter than anything else so far.
Oh, right? Yeah.
I really think this is interesting.
I do think it's a story that can be used and told in many different ways, because it is so almost vague
in its telling, if we can say that.
Yeah.
We can really sort of use this as like pro-British, anti-British, pro-colonialism, anti-colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
What these people sort of did and what they accomplished is something that's sort of mythologized, and deservedly so.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Mm-hmm. And just that name, the Society of Masterless Men, it's just such a, like, that is a solid name for your group.
And by the way, it has become an actual group. There's a, not a group, like a music group. It's been used in folk music, in Irish folk music for a while now.
God, I love Irish folk music.
Oh yeah, we're going to talk about it later. I can't wait.
Just in types of, it's the idea of the new world is lived to its fruition with the Society of Masterless Men. The whole idea of free from religious persecution, that whole sort of fantasy idea that people had when they went to the new world, is lived on in the Society of Masterless Men in its most like clear-cut form.
Oh yeah, it's the most on-the-nose example of the natural right to freedom.
Especially since it's Irish people doing it.
Yes, exactly. So I can totally get why, even if you take either stance, right, it would be latched onto by so many people, even within like the divisions of the Irish community, as indicative of what you can do in North America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to start with this story as a kind of entryway into the cultural imaginings of the Irish.
I just love that name. It's really like just to deep dive into the name for a second, the fact like, yep, Masterless Men, already some good alliteration going on there, but Society already denoting that it is some sort of community group without any sort of leader,
mm-hmm,
or sort of hierarchical and structured system, yep, really speaks out against what was happening at the time in the colonies. There's a very set hierarchy of power, you know. You had the landed lords, and then you had the merchant class, and then you had the people who were just trying to find a better life. Honestly, I feel like the Society of Masterless Men was the movement that tried to start, say, today. And it was a group of people that were saying, let's go bugger off and live in the north or something, try and find our way to live on our own. Like, it could get some traction.
I would think so too, yeah.
As long as they need to change their name, Society of Masterless People.
Absolutely. But I do like the point that you bring up, that they're kind of indicative of the hierarchy and lack thereof in the new world, where you see this especially in New France, but
this very strong imposition of order,
yes,
on an orderless world.
But exactly, it's the orderless world that's very interesting here, is that there's an attempt to impose order, but because the order is literally an ocean away, it's very hard to actually impose something,
which is why there's so many structures surrounding it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You got governor generals, or before that, what was the old New France system? It was the intendant.
Yep.
The bishop and the governor. Yep. Yeah. It was the big, wasn't it? The big three: bishop, intendant, and governor. Then lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
And then they had their own structures and systems, which has its own structures and systems, and it's on and on. And just have a queen or a king or whatever, man. All power, yeah, to one person. That's what I say.
Okay. Yep. You heard it here first.
That person is me.
The official Historia Canadiana stance for this episode is loyalism. Anyway.
Loyalism to the lizard people.
That's our alliteration for today. That's going to be our next t-shirt, loyalism to the lizard people.
Loving loyalty to lizard lords.
Thank
languishing
you.
Lavaciously.
Is that going to be our new thing now? It's just going to be alliterative titles for just these weird people?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Always.
Okay.
Weird people. The last one was poets. Poets are just weird people.
I mean, I would call Longfellow a weird person.
Yeah. Anyway,
moving on a few decades, right? So where we were talking about the 1750s, the beginning of British Empire in Canada, you get a second, example in 1804 by an Irish poet named Thomas More, who was visiting Canada and going down the St. Lawrence with a couple of Canadiens, or voyageurs, right? So basically French-Canadian travelers or boatsmen across the St. Lawrence. And inspired by not only their local songs, but by what he sees around him, writes what would essentially become the quintessential folk poem, and would actually be taught in schools for some time as this kind of folksy tune. And it's called, very simply, A Canadian Boat Song. Right. Now, I'll link it again in the description, because there's more than one Canadian boat song in Canadian letters.
I'm sorry. That's such a Canadian fact.
There's one. There's more than one Canadian boat song.
Right.
But there's the one about the flying canoe too.
But there's one, right, about that was written like 30 years after this one that we're talking about here.
Stole the goddamn name because they couldn't think of something more original than a Canadian boat song.
Unfortunately, we don't know who wrote the second one. They didn't even have the guts to ascribe their name to their plagiarism. Boo.
What a fucking coward.
Sing the song for us, Patrick.
I don't know the air, though. But yeah, Canadian Boat Song is like a really short poem. And like I said, I'll link to it. You can find it. It's in the public domain. I'll link it on our website. What did you think of this one?
I mean, it is about a boat.
Yep.
In Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't lying.
Nope.
Which is nice. I like it. It's short, sweet, gets to the point. You know, it's a fun little poem.
I think more than anything, it's kind of indicative of everything surrounding the Irish at this point. I think the poem is less prone to deconstruction as, say, the Society of Masterless Men's story, just because it is so simple, right? There's three stanzas. There's three stanzas,
each around six lines.
Yeah.
So that's 18 lines. That's a little more than a sonnet.
Yeah. And it is nicely written. I must say it's much better than a lot of the stuff that we read on the show at this time, but
simple rhyming style of A-A-B-B-C-C for each stanza.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think the last stanza is more interesting for me, where he says, Ottawa's tide, this trembling moon shall see us float over thy surges soon. Saint of this green isle, hear our prayers. Oh, grant us cool heavens and favoring airs. Blow, breezes blow.
The streams run fast. The rapids are near and the daylight's past.
Thank you.
I think that's actually kind of interesting transition that happens within the poem, because that's the line that gets repeated through each stanza. But the first one is, row, brothers, row, the stream runs fast, as if the boat is still getting out of the harbor, and then it switches. See, as far as I'm not, again, if you've listened to the show at all, you know I'm not a huge poetry fan, to put it kindly. But I think what's happening here is actually kind of interesting and kind of fun take, and it's sort of a nice little quick, it's something you could definitely sing or say to yourself. I could see why this would get popular, why this would sort of become well known. It's something that just sort of breezes through. Breezes blow.
Exactly.
It just streams through taverns throughout the city.
To me, this is indicative of a lot of the folk songs that the Irish would become well known for later. And that would integrate into mainstream Canadian folk as we know it, from Quebec all the way to the Maritimes. And in Ontario, a lot of folk songs are influenced by this kind of Irish tune. And I think the fact that Canadian Boat Song was a poem inspired by French Canadians from an Irish person, and that it was kind of adopted into the mainstream vernacular, the mainstream idea of poetry for some time, I think is very indicative of the way in which, the subtle ways in which the Irish kind of permeate into all kinds of aspects of Canadian society, especially at that time, or even at that time, rather.
Right.
So I think that's probably the most noteworthy thing of this poem. I would recommend reading it in its full. It's not long, and it's
really
what Irish melodies looked like and what people thought were Canada was like, and the place of the Irish and French Canadians at the time.
Compared to other poems that get into the 100 lines long, and I generally or usually just find kind of pretentious and overly flowery descriptive, this is 18 lines. It's quick, easy, breezy, cover girl.
But I think the fact of pretension is a really interesting one to bring up, right?
Yeah.
I don't think he's trying to be pretentious. Well, we have a tendency to imagine poets in general as these pretentious types. I think that this is one of the examples in which you're trying to make something for the people, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're among voyageurs, as they're saying. These are as close to the common person as you can get. And this is something that everyone can unite around. And that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of folk songs after, right?
Honestly, like it's just something that's nice. It's not something that's meant to be serious. It's just something for morale.
Yes.
More than anything else. It's just to help people feel a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that it's also on a boat is very relevant, right? Morale and during a trip, morale during like this voyage where you're far from home, you're in this wilderness as very aptly described in the poem itself, right? You're in this wilderness that Canada is at the time, especially near Ottawa, where it's, you're on the edge of empire, you're on the edge of the frontier at this time. And it's just really the perfectly indicative of everything else surrounding the poem. Yeah.
No, there's not a lot to say about this poem other than that it's just kind of nice.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I chose these two, I guess, cultural items just because they're so indicative of many of the things that we'll later see with the Irish.
Mm.
That being said, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about what is really the most well-known period of Irish immigration, that is post-1815, wherein most of the Irish are going to be arriving and their impact will be more accurately felt. And we're back. So in thinking about post-1815, I think we should establish a few ideas, right? What makes it completely distinct from the previous waves of Irish? So we're talking here not only much higher numbers of Irish immigrants, in part because of the pressures that indeed the Industrial Revolution put on the still very agrarian Ireland, and in part because of the pressures that Great Britain was putting on them because of the now different responsibilities and perceptions that they have as part of the United Kingdom. So we're estimating here that between 1815 and 1864, there was an average Irish immigration of about 20,000 Irish per year, right? That's a massive amount of people coming in pre-Confederation Canada, right? And that leads to exactly what we were saying, right? That Gaelic was extremely spoken in British North America and Eastern Canada. The Irish were about 25% of the population. And in total, we estimate that about 600,000 Irish people will arrive in Canada between 1825 and 1864. And as we mentioned at the top of the episode, a lot of this migration, right, will come during the famine, especially during the Black 47 year, where a lot of the Irish will come.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot who do come outside of the famine years. And, you know, as we said, we already talked about the Ghosil and the famished Irish. But this idea that they're coming in droves is kind of underlying a lot of this discussion. One of the things that I think is important to keep in mind during the second half of the episode is that because there are such larger numbers of Irish that are coming, right, it's much less eclectic, it's much less spread out than in the first waves, the divides between Irish communities are going to be inherently much more noticeable because suddenly you have hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of Irish in urban centers, right? So you suddenly have, for example, Catholics and Protestants in close proximity to one another in a same space, whereas before the Catholics were mostly still in their farms in Ireland and the Protestants were still mostly in the cities, right? There was still a division, both physical and social, between the two. And that's a kind of division that got smaller and smaller as they got to Canada.
Stick all the little groups with tensions between them into the same place to talk it out.
I mean, to be fair, eventually they kind of did.
Eventually,
but you'd have to go through a few riots first, which we'll get into.
A couple of riots, a couple of car bombs also.
For this second part, I think we are going to mostly cover music, religion, and politics. Right? Mm. And you might be thinking, hey, but St. Paddy's Day is in there. Yes, and we're going to cover it in religion because it is intrinsically tied to how the Irish perceive religion at that time.
And how the Irish are perceived in relation to religion.
Absolutely. So we're going to cover it under that section. So I guess already kind of going off of what we were saying for the Canadian Boat Song, right? Thomas More's short poem, we can start talking about folk music, right?
Yes.
Which in the Irish tradition is often considered as this come all ye style, right? Which sometimes actually the songs do start off with that. And it kind of kicks off exactly what we were saying, is they're very simple songs. They're songs that are made with instruments like the fiddle. They're very portable instruments. The uli and pipes are used. These very small instruments that can be transported across the ocean with relative ease, right? Mm-hmm. If you want an example of what an Irish fiddle looks like, I'll link to an unidentified Irish tune in the description, one that I couldn't unfortunately download for this episode, but that's a good example. And don't worry, because we've gotten this comment in the past, yes, I will be putting one of the songs within the actual audio of the
episode
podcast. Yeah.
Ah, cool.
Because people didn't want to actually stop the episode, go listen to the songs and come back, which is fair. The point is, you have these simple instruments, you have these simple ballads, right? And you have these really catchy tunes that literally can be sung by all around a fire, around a pub.
Right? I mean,
literally, come all ye.
It's that old expression of you have to be able to carry a tune. Mm-hmm. This music is designed that you could carry this tune with one finger.
Yes.
You know, you don't need any special tools or anything. This is all like, and it's great. I love this kind of music.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the example that we took for this episode is a song, in this case, interpreted by Great Big Sea, called Eyes the Bye That Builds the Boat, which I will include right here.
Eyes the bye that builds the boat, and eyes the bye that sails her, and eyes the bye that catches the fish and brings them home to Liza. Hip your partner, Sally T. Bow, hip your partner, Sally Brown, Fogle, Twilling, Morton's Harbour, all around the circle. Salts and rinds to cover your flake, cake and tea for supper, cod fishing in the spring of the year, fried in maggoty butter. Hip your partner, Sally T. Bow, hip your partner, Sally Brown, Fogle, Twilling, Morton's Harbour, all around the circle.
Eyes the Bye That Builds the Boat is, I think, perfectly encapsulates what we're talking about here. It's written a lot with just this choral of, in this case, men. It's four-line stanzas, seven stresses each. It's very easy to remember, and you get these choruses that are absolutely catchy, right? And most importantly, and I think for me most importantly, themes that everyone can relate to. And I think that's integral to understanding folk music. But yeah, what's your general sense of Irish folk music, and like how do you see it?
Because Irish folk music is sort of different than that idea that you can have of folk music of like Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
You know, that sort of jaunty jiggy tunes that you get in your head of Irish folk music. If you're looking for examples, just like look up the band The Dubliners.
Yeah, absolutely. And
they're probably the most well-known.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's very, very high energy, sort of made for lots of people. It's hard to sort of explain how a music is when you can just listen to it.
Yeah. I'll link to a bunch of them below so you can kind of get, but I think your point of differentiating between what Bob Dylan sounds like, this more bluegrass kind of folk, mm-hmm. versus exactly this fiddle-based and stomping
very
based.
High energy, upbeat. It's meant to be like, this is stuff you really want. You can only really start dancing to if you're a good dancer, or if you're drunk enough to think you're a good dancer.
Yes. So if you want, for like those music aficionados out there, it's often in a tempo that goes by a 6-8 beat. So you'll have something like 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. That'll be 6-8. So it's much higher than your standard.
Dance, dance, wherever you may be. I am the Lord of the Dance, said he. I'll lead you all wherever you may be. I will lead you all in the dance, said he. That kind of speed, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's much more different than your regular pop song, which is often in 3-4 or 4-4. So 1-2-3, 1-2-3.
Based around the four chords.
The influence that the Irish had on music, and as we said, language, right? Eventually, there would even be what's known as Canadian Gaelic, for example. It's kind of interesting that today we don't really think much about Canadian folk music, right, as a thing. When we think about Canadian artists, we often think of The Weeknd, we often think of Michael Bublé and stuff like that, right? Modern pop artists, as one would expect. But when we think of traditional Canadian folk songs of the likes of Great Big Sea, as we link to the likes of Stan Rogers during the 60s, you can listen to clips of Don Messer's sing-along Jubilee, right, which passed on CBC during the 50s. The that kind of style is profoundly influenced by the Irish. The heavy use of fiddles is like the really well-known one. But I think in terms of themes, it's kind of hard to understate the importance. And you see that all the way to the modern day, for example, even in Quebec, in French folk songs today, you'll see exactly those same kind of themes of alienation from work, this kind of cultural independence from a hegemony, whether it's Canada as a concept or Britain at the time. These ideas really permeate all the way down to the modern day. For example, if you want a good example, in Quebec folk songs, the Cowboy Fringant made a song a couple years ago called Marine Marchande, which is, it's basically a French sea shanty. And if it was sung in English, you'd swear it was from Ireland. Like, there's an uncanny resemblance. It's the exact use of instruments. It's the exact same use of themes of this longing for being home. You're far away from everyone you love, but you're still trying to build this community here in Canada, right? And I think that's one of the major tenets of folk music, is the building of communities, right? More than poetry, which can be a bit inaccessible, more even than politics. I think folk music is one of those quintessential ways that the Irish, among other people, used in order to build their own communities in Canada and ostensibly integrate into normative Canadian society as it was known, right? Bringing in a lot of these people from different backgrounds with songs that everyone can relate to. I don't know. Did you have any thoughts about that? Or
about folk music, this deep dive you just did?
Exactly. I guess went on a diatribe of it. I had a lot of thoughts on folk music, but yeah.
I like fiddles.
You were mentioning right before the show that you listen to a lot of this kind of music, right?
I do, yes. It's something that's sort of nice and pleasant to listen to when I'm out for walks or and such, just because it is so, the content is always so disconnected. Mm-hmm. It's always a journey or an adventure, because it's still in that old fashioned sense of telling a tale.
Yes. I think that's very important to bring up, right? It's exactly what we were saying with Thomas More. He's telling a tale about something that he's telling a journey.
Yeah, and it's often very simple tales or something of the such. You know, one of my favorites is Black Velvet Band. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple tale about a man and his relationship with a girl with a black velvet band.
Exactly. But
it's comfort. It's meant to be something comforting. You're singing this at a pub or such and such area where people are just trying to like relax, forget about the shitty lives that they're living in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, forget the fact that they're being pressured and being judged against all the time. Mm-hmm. Just trying to have some fun, man.
Do you think, I wrote this down as a question, do you think this is what pop music is trying to be in a sense? I think in a certain sense, yes, except it fails to capture the kind of power of it.
I think what happens with pop music is the fact that there's a much larger industry for it now. And laws and copyright have changed so much, because it used to be any person can sort of play any song at any sort of pub, and you didn't really care about if the person was just playing like covers or whatever, you know, you didn't worry about it. And if they were making money off of it, it wasn't a big deal.
No, because that wasn't the point.
No. Now there's a very rooted in the monetary section where people, and it's rightly so, like you've created something, you want to get paid for what you have created. Totally get that. But it's sort of become this thing where now this, the sort of consideration of pop music has to be popular with the masses. It doesn't have to resonate with them, or it doesn't have to comfort them. It just has to be popular. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's really the major thing that's lacking from pop music in regards to folks and how it relates to folk song. I mean,
I think there still is pop music that does that. And we still have artists out there who, again, like write these things where they're trying to either comfort people or trying to have their own story or message. Again, we talked about over on Pop Canada, if you want to take a listen, we talked about The Weeknd, who often does try and do similar things where he's using the genre of pop music and such to try and tell these larger stories or narratives and either provide a comfort of some kind.
Yeah. But I think by and large, I think your point of selling something versus just feeling something or resonating with something, I think is like a major distinction that needs to be noted here.
Well, because at the time when they wrote this music, they knew they couldn't sell it. There wasn't the sort of structure to sell it. So like, if I can't sell it anyway, I might as well just like have fun with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else?
I like fiddles. Just love me some good fiddling, man. On a roof or otherwise.
I guess as a way to blend into religion and politics. We've been talking a lot about this sense of building a community and this sense of bringing all kinds of people into this idea of Irishness, into this idea of being in Canada, however you want to look at it. There's an interesting thing that happens in that a lot of these songs, a lot of these poems will be used with specific political and religious intent, right? And as it pertains to the Irish in this case, but in Canadian society in general during the 19th century, the two are intrinsically related, right? You can't really dissociate, or it's very hard to dissociate religion and politics. Not necessarily because all politics are religious, but because religious institutions are so profoundly enmeshed in political decisions.
Mm-hmm. What else is there to say with religion except just internal screaming?
Yeah. But yeah, one of the things that I think is going to be interesting to more or less cap off this episode is to see how various denominations and various political and religious groups used songs and poems, right? So we've been seeing the Irish as this unit. Now we can see them as distinct, right? With their own agendas in some sense, much like anyone else. And a good way to frame this is to reestablish some of the major or more conventional divisions that we see within the Irish community, right? Within Irish history, or at least relatively modern Irish history, the Protestant denomination has most notably in Canada been associated with what's called the Orange Order, right? The Orange Order, which is a fraternal organization, it's explicitly Protestant and virulently anti-Catholic, especially at this time, less so now. But it's a Protestant fraternity, almost a secret society.
And, yay, secret societies.
Oh yeah, straight up. We could almost do a whole episode just on the Orange Order because some of our prime ministers actually were part of it.
Canada.
Like, almost 100 years apart, actually. So John A. Macdonald was one, and John Diefenbaker in the 60s was also one. So yeah.
Interesting.
So the Orange Order is basically represents the Protestant elite, if you will, as perceived by the Irish. And the reason it's called Orange is based off of none other than William of Orange, who was kind of seen as this Protestant liberator in Ireland during this rebellion that happened in the 17th century. And they kind of took up that name as a symbol of elite Protestantism.
Yay.
So it started off in Ireland, but eventually there would be an Orange Order in Canada. And it would be consolidated in 1830 by a man named Ogle Gowan in Ontario. There was a bunch of lodges, and he basically brought them all together, and he was eventually the Grand Master of the Orange Order of Canada. And basically, they just went around being ultra-bigoted against the French Canadians and being a part of normative British politics. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the ultimate way that we can describe the Orange Order, in a short and concise way. If you want to look more into them, they kind of suck, but they had a huge influence for the time.
Right? Like most secret societies.
Yeah. They had like a bunch of parades as Orange Order, not necessarily as part of St. Patrick's Day or something like that, but they had their own parades. They had their own traditions, and they're very much part of this loyalist tradition in Canada. And I think one of the ways in which we can look at that is exactly through the medley that you were mentioning before. I'll read like maybe the up until the second chorus, because it's really not that long, and it aptly represents the way in which songs were used by religious denominations. And then we'll cover like a Catholic one, for example. So this is actually a medley of a variety of songs and tunes composed in honor of what was known as the Grand Procession of the Orange Order that took place in Toronto in 1852.
All sung along to the melody of Auld Lang Syne.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to sing it.
I can do it.
Go for it. Honestly, go nuts.
Blessed shade of that immortal king who nobly crossed Boyne's flood. Teach me his praises loud to sing for us who shed his blood. May every year new glory get to those of William's line, and may his sons forever live to meet their sire divine. But here's to those who each delight their brethren do join, to celebrate the glorious day King William crossed the Boyne. The Orange men from far and near in July 52 by Toronto men invited were 1,000 good and true, that in their city all should meet about the hour of noon, and then proceed from street to street throughout that loyal town. Then here's to those who each of July their brethren do join, to celebrate the glorious day King William crossed the Boyne.
That was beautiful.
I think that's how it would go if I'm remembering the melody of Auld Lang Syne correctly.
That's exactly the melody, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the medley goes on for like 4 pages. We're not going to read it all. It'll be linked again. But it is kind of interesting to me. There are certain passages that I think are really indicative. So obviously there's the necessary references to King William of Orange crossing the Boyne, which was kind of the image of William crossing into Ireland and liberating Ireland and making it Protestant or whatever.
Yeah.
As far as the Protestants are concerned, liberating Ireland, by the way, completely ignoring the Catholic majority, but that's another thing. And of course, that's something that happened presumably on July 12th, which was the Orange Day, basically. But there's a few lines at the end of the passage you read, which I think were really interesting. And that's 1,000 good and true that in their city all should meet about the hour of noon and then proceed from street to street throughout that loyal town. It really gives, and obviously this is a form of propaganda in a sense, right? You're trying to value a certain purview of, in this case, Toronto, but it really gives this overt impression of Toronto being a loyalist city, right? There's no other kind of people. It's a loyal town. There are 1,000 people that are good and true. All these people that are a part of this parade, you know, representing a real majority. And there's this sense of joy as this procession is happening, right? It really gives this impression of grand acceptance of the Orange Order as the Irish voice, if you will, right, of Toronto.
Toronto. It's an interesting thing, again, sort of fitting into that idea of you're trying to use the songs and poetry more to rally the people than it is trying to provide some grand introspection onto the meaning of life and such.
Yeah, I don't think any of their goals was this grand introspection. It would have definitely been, if there's any introspection that would have been done, it would have been how do we maneuver any political, like,
propaganda
power. Yeah, propaganda, as you say, right? So in this like act of support of anti-Catholicism and political conservatism, which again, they're not wrong. There were quite a few people that were members of the Orange Order at the time in Toronto, but it does give this kind of skewered version that it was a lot of people and that it was the majority of people, which wasn't necessarily the case. And it really increasingly was not necessarily the case that all of them were diehard loyalists or that there wasn't some leeway to be had. For example, Ogle Gowan himself would be someone who kind of represents this duality. He would actually be in favor of responsible government when it became a debate within British North American Parliament. Even though he was a loyalist, even though he was the founder of the Consolidated Orange Order in Canada. So it does try kind of open up into this duality that a lot of people in Ireland represented, or at least a lot of the Irish in Canada represented.
Right.
I want to contrast this with a little excerpt from a poem that was written a bit later by a man called Carol Ryan, but this idea of the wearing of the green, which is the name of the poem, dates back all the way to the 18th century, right? This is a song that was sung during the Irish rebellions that happened in 1798. And as we will see, the wearing of the green is kind of associated with Catholicism and kind of lower class Irish, but again, this will kind of show the duality of what I mean here. In 1903, Carol Ryan wrote The Wearing of the Green. And here's a little excerpt from this. It goes, "And ever on St. Patrick's Day, wherever to the skies, triumphantly for liberty, the flag of Britain flies. There shall the harp and shamrock fly, by all the nations seen, to Irish valor Britain owes the wearing of the green. So now we'll wear the green, my dear, so now we'll wear the green, for Erin Grand will proudly stand and wear the living green." I think this is really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I especially like the kind of duality that says, like, on St. Patrick's Day, which we'll get into it, but at the time was a bit more explicitly Catholic, by the way. The duality of the flag of Britain, and at the same time, the Aeolian harp and the shamrocks kind of both being there at the same time, while also saying, to Irish valor, Britain owes. So you get this Catholic who, in popular imaginations of the Irish, are virulently anti-British, and a lot of them were, don't get me wrong, but in this case, a rather loyal one in some senses, or at least accepting of the fact that there is some good that can be had within the British system somehow.
Somehow.
But you know, you get what I mean, right?
Yeah, for sure.
There's this interesting dichotomy going on within both of these works that I think is important to note. Yeah, I don't know. Did you have any thoughts on this?
I think compliment is a pretty interesting word to use, you know? These groups are in tension with each other, but in the end, they're still Irish.
Yeah, okay.
And how there's, again, this image of we have of the collective as Irish, but then that's not really the case. It does help explain the colors on the Ireland flag.
Okay, you didn't know that's where it came from?
Nope.
Ah, okay, yes. So it's Irish and Protestant. I forget what the
word Irish is. And Protestant? You're saying Protestants aren't Irish?
It's exactly. They're faux Irish.
No, it is. It is kind of fascinating, the tension that exists in this group and how the colors came to be what was so representative of them. Mm-hmm. And how the Irish green Catholics kind of became the predominant color of Ireland.
Yeah, okay.
But then that green is sort of linked with the more natural paganistic aspects. Yeah. I'd be interested to see how that link came to be. Because, you know, that idea of, like, the green then linking to the leprechaun, the shamrock, the fairy circles and all that of Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Emerald Isle, as it is.
Yeah, I think exactly that. It's just because the orange aspect of it was so elite, right? And because it was so deliberately secretive, right? It was deliberately something that was a bit cut off from the general population. Yes, there were these processions, for example, as we just saw through the streets of Toronto, but it was still something.
The streets of where?
Of Toronto.
Toronto.
So, but you still had this kind of divide between who could actually join. Whereas, even though not everyone was Catholic, right? Everyone could wear the green. It was a much more common practice, if you will. And as we just mentioned, and as we'll get into, St. Patrick's Day was its colors were much more explicitly green, and so you had this really massive movements that deliberately showed green. And as the decades wore on, the Orange Order itself would kind of die down, even though Protestantism was still a thing, but the Orange Order itself would kind of die down in Canada. And so it mostly left the green aspects of Ireland, even though people don't necessarily associate it with Catholicism anymore. At least that would be my idea as to why people associate the green more than anything else. Similarly, why they would associate like the shamrock and stuff like that. Yeah, I guess now's as good a time as any to cap off with our last part, and that is St. Patrick's Day. Right? Because as we mentioned, the Orange Order had their own processions, and we named one in 1852, but they had them pretty much every year. And sometimes they were big enough to actually cause controversy with some of the royalty, as in they had these big processions. The royalty would visit, and they would be offended if the royalty did not stop by the Orange Order procession. Right. And it would completely stop certain like royal passages and force them to make a detour to see the Orange Order.
Oh my God.
No. Like we're talking, this is huge, right?
But also kind of petty. It's kind of hilarious.
Yeah, it's very petty. It's exactly what I'd expect from a bunch of elitists like the Orange Order. who, by the way, I don't mind lambasting, not only because they're very small in Canada now, but now because they've also been kind of marked as this white supremacist group.
Oh, wow.
In like modern times by a lot of people, mostly Irish Republicans, but I don't give a crap about lambasting them. Tell me in the comments.
So, my God. That's...
Yeah, it got kind of dark.
Kind of?
I don't want to give like the impression that they all are, but it's been kind of painted as such because of its history of elitism and Protestantism that's intrinsically associated, as we were talking about, with whiteness and what proper Britishness is. Mm-hmm. So it's, I can understand where some of that criticism comes from. Anyway, there's like five people in the Orange Order now in Canada, so who cares? But
we can bully them now because of that.
But yeah, in kind of contrast to that and to those orange processions, you had St. Paddy's Day, which wasn't officially exclusively Catholic, but definitely took on these Catholic connotations, mostly because St. Patrick is associated much more with Catholicism, but also just saints in general are a much more Catholic phenomenon than they are in Protestant circles. And the first St. Patrick's Day parade would be held where you are, back in Montreal, in 1824. There would actually be some before in the States, but in Canada, the first one is in 1824, almost 200 years ago. And there would be these regular parades, much like the Orange Order, and you'd see the singing of songs like the one we read by Carol Ryan. And it is interesting to note, by the way, that the St. Patrick's Day festivals and parades and stuff like that actually began in North America, not in Ireland. It's because St. Patrick's Day was this day in Ireland where everything was closed and it was a religious holiday. It wasn't the secular holiday, or more secularized rather, holiday like it became in North America. In fact, like this idea of St. Patrick's Day as this Irish celebration where you drink and get rowdy would ironically not have been very drinky or rowdy in Ireland, because the pubs would have been closed. So it's
North America.
It's an exclusively North American phenomenon that was started by like nostalgic and proud Irish people.
I've seen nostalgia and pride do worse than just start a day where people get together to get drunk and have a good time.
Absolutely. But I want to bring up St. Paddy's Day because it shows once again this kind of antagonism that simultaneously exists and doesn't exist in Irish communities. Because, you know, the riots I mentioned earlier?
Oh, God.
It's kind of funny how associated with riots St. Patrick's Day became.
Of course it did.
Because the Orange Order, among other people, got kind of pissy that St. Patrick's Day became a thing. And that it was used to sing these disloyal songs to the empire. And so it would often lead to direct antagonism between people of the Orange Order and Catholics that were celebrating St. Patrick's Day. And there would be fights and riots in the streets. And like, it happened pretty regularly. One of them that's really well known, that you can look it up, is in 1858 in Toronto. And the riots that ensued from it led directly to discussions and eventually the enforcing of a banning on the St. Patrick's Day parade in Toronto for over a century. So until 1988, Toronto couldn't hold a St. Patrick's Day parade because of the potential for violence that ensued from it. So I think that's fascinating. That this kind of day that now everyone kind of gets on board with us, like that one moment where everyone's a little bit Irish and really celebrates it hard, was initially a day of super antagonism.
Right.
Do you celebrate St. Paddy's Day?
Not really. I mean, you know, with my sister, we might, like, this time we just got some smoothies or Irish slushies or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, we might eat a certain meal. Like, we had Guinness beef stew. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That was about it, really.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know. Like, do you have any thoughts on the fact that it kind of started out as what I was just describing? It had these themes to it that were explicitly meant to or at least to enhance the bonds of the Irish Catholic community and eventually the full Irish community. And it's kind of become this joke, if you will. Not really a joke. I wouldn't call it a joke, but it's become kind of this theme of drunkenness and excess. I don't know. I feel like there's there's been kind of a warping of what it was originally meant to be, even though I'm not someone who's explicitly pro-religion at all. But I do think it's interesting to note how it's shifted over the years into something that's just kind of there as this surface level representation of Irishness.
Right.
We're kind of winding down here. Where we've, as we say, we were talking just basically about general cultural impacts here.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you want to mention in particular about anything that we've talked about today? Like, what to you, I guess, to kind of open up that question is there like a particular notable Irish influence in your opinion on Canada as we've seen it today?
Oh boy.
Like one that really sticks out as something like, yes, Irish. Because by the way, we'll get into like later ones as we go later into our chronology, but
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's probably is just so many important Irish Canadians that we just don't know. And that's really one of those problems that we talked about before where we should be looking more into it.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting that you bring that up. I think one of the, and this I'm saying it as kind of a way to open up to later episodes that we're going to be talking about the Irish, right? As we kind of mentioned throughout the episode.
Oh, damn.
The Irish would eventually integrate really fully into mainstream Canadian society, as it were, right, or as it was understood for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting, again, that they represent both this image of Canada as a cultural mosaic, but also a kind of American melting pot, in that you don't really notice the Irish anymore as explicitly Irish, much like they had been for most of the 19th century that we were talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting to note is that there's a lot of scholars that kind of indicate the role of the Irish Canadians in forming a sense of Canadian nationalism, or in forming one. Because a lot of the things that we were talking about today become kind of foundational to what we'd understand as traditional Canadian culture.
Right.
Folk music was very influenced. These interpretations of religion, these
overall Canadian sense of comedy.
Yes, absolutely. Comedy was definitely influenced. I talked a bit more about that with my Scottish episode that I did, but comedy was definitely influenced by Gaelic types. The contribution to a sense of Canadian nationalism as something distinct, distinctly Canadian, but also kind of British, but also kind of multicultural, definitely was helped by Irish.
The large Irish population.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah, just there's just an overarching prevailing sense of Irishness that isn't really sort of talked about with Canada, you know?
Yeah.
Just in either behavior, mannerisms.
Mm-hmm. Even right down to the military, by the way, we'll see that later. The Canadian military and like things like the RCMP are explicitly modeled after certain Irish groups.
There you go.
Also, you were talking about really important like political figures or figures of Irish Canadian descent.
Brian Mulroney,
yes, definitely one. Also, and
Paul Mulcair.
Yep. Okay. Keep going.
Alice Munro.
Yep. Alice Munro.
Connor McDavid.
I don't know who that is.
He's a hockey player. Yourself Canadian.
Anyway, no, what I was going to mention, and it's a bit closer to our purview here, is a man called Thomas Darcy McGee, who we will definitely cover on this show as a full episode, because not only is he a writer, but he became explicitly tied into kind of the pro and anti-Fenian raids that were going on in Canada in the 1860s, which was an Irish nationalist group that mm-hmm. attacked Canada. And Thomas Darcy McGee became one of the founding, like one of the so-called fathers of Confederation.
Woo!
So the Irish, again, once again, are explicitly there in Canadian semiotics in terms of images that we have imagined of them. They're explicitly there in politics, as we will see most importantly with McGee later. And we are explicitly relating them to religion and just these general Irishness and Canadianness, as we will see it develop over the course of many episodes. So I think that in itself is the largest contribution that we can attribute to the Irish.
There you go.
All right. Did you have any final thoughts?
I like fiddles.
Nice. I don't know. I think this was a decent format. We maybe have talked a lot about cultural items, it's, like different ones, but I think it was
may have seemed like we were beating around a lot of bushes or not being very specific with anything, but it's that's just sort of what happens when you talk about one of the larger cultural influences on our nation as a whole.
Yeah. And again, we're going to be talking about specific ones later, right? I just wanted to set the groundwork with this one.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, obviously, as always, the ultimate way to send us off. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can send them over through rants. Facebook, through Twitter. Yeah, if you have rants also. You can send them through by email at historiacanadiana@gmail.com. And, of course, you can, tell us we suck. I don't know. I don't care. You can leave a review, maybe 1 star, preferably 5. It takes about 1 second, guys. Go on iTunes, click a 5-star review. It really helps the show get to more ears.
Or if you feel like a 3 is fine.
Yeah, I can do with a 3.
I'd put my word for the 3 stars.
Okay. That's fine. I like our show.
I like our show too.
I think it deserves at least like a 3.5. And as for support, as we mentioned, you can do it through PayPal, a kind of pay what you think the show is worth. You can check out the recommended reading page and the affiliate links that are there. And you can support the show, I think most importantly, through our Patreon page, where you can get ad-free episodes and uncut episodes and early episodes, and most importantly, extra episodes every month. Mac, why don't you tell them about Pop Canada?
Pop Canada is a special show, one episode every month, released straight to Patreon, where we just talk about how Canada fits into the larger pop cultural landscape of the world. Again, sort of like what we did with Ireland, we sort of pick a topic, chat around it, talk about it. Last month was the Gold Rush, the Klondike Gold Rush, and how that sort of fit into the larger mythologization of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
We'll pick a topic, a person, a place, an event, a movie, a TV show, comic book series of some kind maybe, and just sort of give our thoughts. It's a lot more open and freewheeling, I would say, than the main show. A lot more of hijinks, shenanigans, open language.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really
it's the like one that I put together.
And that's why it's a much better show. But you can check it out and you can have access to Pop Canada for as little as $3 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So with that being said, we want to thank you all again for listening to us ramble about yet another topic as it pertains to Canadian culture and history. We'll see you all next time on Historia Canadiana. Cheers, everyone. Woo-hoo.